And all this time, Lieutenant Alley just sat back there without saying a damned word. Furthermore, it was hot as hell in the cockpit. Eventually, he asked me, how much more time have you got on this leg? And I looked at my computations and
gave him an answer.
And gave him what appeared to be the answer. So he said, go on. And I went on when the time was up, in other words, when I was supposed to have reached objective number one, which was some little town there in Georgia. He opened the hood, that is, this black cloth thing that covered up the canopy so you couldn't see out. He could release it and it would fly back and you could see. And I saw that there was some town there. Didn't look like the town I was headed for. Anyway, he said, okay, put the hood back on. So I did, and I changed course. And, he said, go on. And I thought, well, damn you. You know already that I'm way off course by this time, and you're just going to make me finish out this triangular thing according to my computations, and you know that I'll be miles off before I get back to the end of the third leg. But I did what he told me, and it continued the same way, absolutely bumpy and terrible, and the compass going this way and that way. And when I had reached the end of the second leg, I just, he didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything. I just changed course and headed back for what, of course, it was supposed to take me back to Spence Field. And eventually, when the time was nearly up for the end of that leg, he automatically released the canopy, and the hood, and I could see Spence Field over there, and I went inland, and he never said anything at all. But when we got on the ground, he said, that was a rough flight, wasn't it? And I said, yeah. And he said, I hope that taught you something. He said, we don't have people fly these triangular courses on instruments for nothing, and I'm glad it was the kind of day it was. And what I hope you learn today is that when the air is as rough as that, there is nothing you can do about it except try to keep the compass on the course as best you can. Fly out your elapsed time on each leg, and you probably are not going to be far off. But you see, you thought when I let the hood off that first town that you were at the wrong place. But he said, that's the second thing I want you to learn. All these little Georgia towns look alike. They're all built around a square with a courthouse in the middle, and you can't tell one from the other. So in the future, when you're faced with a problem like this, do exactly what you did today. Stick to your course, stick to your time, watch the clock, and when the time is up, take up the next leg. And you're probably not going to go far wrong. But if you get scared and start changing your mind, and you're going to end up far from the place you intended to. And I've found out enough about that sort of flying since to know he was exactly right. It was a valuable lesson. I never forgot it. One of the things you had to learn at advanced flying school was some gunnery. And the way this was arranged for was that we transferred for a week or two down to a place called Eglin, Eglin Field in Florida, in the panhandle down there. It's a field, incidentally, that's still active Air Force base and pretty well known many people even now. We were transferred down there with all our airplanes. We took our airplanes with us. And there they had gunnery ranges. And they had tow targets. They'd have an airplane of some kind towing this long sleeve behind it. with bullseye, a bullseye on it or something, and you practice making fighter passes at this moving target in the air. You also had practice at shooting ground targets. Well, of course, since Lieutenant Alley and the other instructors had at least three students, and there was only one airplane, only one student could fly down. The others had to go by truck or something. And I got elected to be the one to fly down there, and Lieutenant Alley was going to go with me. He was going to sit in the back seat, but the navigation and all was up to me. Well, I was quite pleased about this in the first place. The second place, I thought I would see that he didn't pay too much attention to what I was doing, because the airplanes didn't fly down to Eglin Field in a formation or anything. We flew individually at intervals of several minutes, I don't know what. So you were alone in the air as far as you could see at any given time. And access to the field was restricted, so you couldn't fly a straight line course from Moultrie to Eglin. You had to fly along across the southern part of Georgia, and then when you got to a certain point in relation to Eglin Field, then you made a 90-degree turn to the left or something and flew in through a certain corridor. The reason for that was that, A, there was a lot of gunnery going on there, and it was dangerous in some areas. In the second place, they were doing a lot of research on B-17s and other aircraft down there. It was a big research center and still is. So you had to be careful how you went in there. Well, I knew that Jack Alley was a great reader of comic books. And I saw to it that the day before we left, I went into town or someplace and got a big handful of comic books. And when he appeared down at the flight line and we were ready to go, I presented him with these books. I think he was probably more amused than he let on, but he just kind of grinned and didn't say anything. But he took the comic books. And during the flight down to Eglin Field, I did, every time I'd look in the mirror, I could see he was back there deeply engrossed in one of those books. And my scheme came off very well. He never paid a bit of attention to where we were or what I did or anything else. And I got down there with no problem. We had a good deal of fun down there, aside from the fact that the gunnery was fun, though difficult. How much I learned, I don't know. The way they would check you, by the way, on this aerial gunnery was that they had different color paint on the bullets that you fired from your gun, and it was known ahead of time which aircraft were going to fire on a given target. And when it was like a big screen, a meshed affair of some sort, the target was. And as those bullets passed through the mesh, they left some of the paint on. So when the targets were brought back to the ground and examined, it was easy to tell who had hit it and where and how, whether he had missed it altogether or hit it part of the time. They also knew how many rounds of ammunition you had fired at it. I don't know how well people came off. I don't think I came off very well in that business, but maybe nobody else did either. I don't know. But the great thing of it was that there were so many of us, we could only fly half a day at a time. And so we would fly in the mornings, and in the afternoon they packed us into trucks and took us all down to the beach, which was might have been my first experience with ocean swimming, for all I know, but it was certainly my first experience of swimming in the Caribbean and that warm, salty water. And we would stay there all afternoon. Then when it got quite late, they'd load us back up and take us back We would shower and put on clean clothes and go eat. It was all quite nice. In order to be fair, of course, somebody else flew Lieutenant Alley back to Spence Field, and I went back in truck, but I had had my share of that fun. The only other significant thing I remember about my stay at Spence Field was on one occasion we had to make a night navigation flight down to Tampa, Florida, spend the night down there and come back the next morning. We did this alone, and each airplane took off about dusk, and about 5 minutes behind the airplane that had taken off before. All the cadets had to do this, and it was just a long string of AT-6s from Moultrie to Tampa, I suppose. Anyway, by this time, of course, it was June, and there was a fair amount of sunlight left after I took off. But it got dark, and I got down there and down to Tampa, I don't know when, late at night, and landed with no problem. And, of course, they were expecting us and really treated us honestly like officers or something, and were put up in very comfortable barracks, and next morning given a good breakfast and a send-off. And it was our first experience, almost, really, landing at another Air Force base, and certainly one that wasn't a training base by any means. It was an operational base with the B-17s or something stationed there. It was all quite heady to me. But I remember being terribly impressed on the way back the next day over Florida. And I remember remarking to people later that I couldn't see what point there was to having a parachute with you, because anybody that had to go down over that part of Florida might as well be dead anyway, because if you weren't killed in the crash, the cottonmouth moccasins and rattlesnakes would surely kill you before you got anywhere. There was just mile after mile after mile after mile of swamp and nothing. I was glad to get back to Spence. That was probably about my last flight at Spence. And finally the time came when we finished our training, finished our flying, and finished our ground school, and we were ready to graduate. And different people had been assigned to different places all over the USA, to Air Force bases. Many of them had been assigned as instructors. And I myself was assigned to stay at Spence Field. But in the meantime, we were granted a leave of absence. And I had tried to arrange to have Mother come down for my graduation, and for some reason that fell through. So I was going to go home instead. At this time, a day or two before graduation, my friend Herbert announced that he was going to quit, that he didn't want to kill anybody, and he was going to quit. And no amount of arguing with him by me or anybody else or the officials at the school did the slightest bit of good. He was determined to quit. And he did. I'm very sorry that I don't know what became of him. I'm sorry I didn't keep in touch with him, because he was a nice guy. And although I appreciated his position, I was not particularly in sympathy with it. We graduated from flying school on the 3rd of July, 1942, and the ceremony took place in the base chapel. And since Mother wasn't there to pin my wings on me, that was done by Lieutenant Alley. I've forgotten to relate one episode here while I was at it. Shortly before graduation, Lieutenant Alley invited his students over to his house for a party one night. There weren't, I suppose there was probably nobody there, but Alley and his wife and me and Engelhard and Doty. I'm sure that's all there was. Anyway, we had they gave us a good dinner, and we drank a lot, and Harry wasn't much of a drinker, and not only became quite drunk, probably, but terribly, terribly sick to the stomach, and probably ruined the party. But anyway, finally it was decided that I had thrown up all I was going to throw up, and this was a good time to get me back to the base. I was wearing at this time a pair of brand new shoes. I mention this for a reason. Anyway, Lieutenant Alley piled us all in his car and took us back to the base and got past the guards somehow. He used to tell about this amusingly the next day. Got back to the car, back to the base, and Engelhard and Doty proceeded to throw me, clothes and all, into the shower and turn on the cold water. And it was a matter of some amusement to the next day because they said that I said, "Well, that's all right, but don't get my $50 shoes wet," or whatever it was. And they obligingly took my $50 shoes off, or I don't know that shoes would cost $50 in those days, but anyway, whatever shoes they were, they took them off. I didn't feel very well the next day, but I didn't have to fly or anything, and I was able to sustain Lieutenant Alley's jeers and grins and smirks. It was nice of him to give us that party, and I liked that man very much. I believe, and I may be wrong, but I believe somebody told me years later that he was killed overseas somewhere. Anyway, we graduated, and I was going to hang around the rest of the day because there was no train out. The train I had to take up to Virginia didn't leave until early the next morning or something of the sort. So I just stayed on the base, as did a certain number of other people. It might interest some people to know the details here about at this point then we were second lieutenants and we were pilots. Well, how does anybody know whether you're a pilot or not? What's to keep anybody from just saying they are? Well, you have something called personnel orders, and just to show you what they consist of, I'll read you this, and it says, dated July 3rd, 1942, personnel orders number 158. Paragraph 88, pursuant to authority contained in paragraph 2, Army Regulations 35-1480, dated November 21, 1932, the following named second lieutenants, Air Corps Reserve, each of whom holds an aeronautical rating, are hereby required to participate in regular and frequent aerial flights at such times as they are called to active duty within the Army Air Forces, U.S. Army, under competent authority and are authorized to participate in regular and frequent aerial flights while on an inactive status, in accordance with the provisions of paragraph 52, Army Regulation 95-15, dated April 21, 1930, by command of Lieutenant General Arnold. Signed, J. M. Bevins, Colonel, Army Air Forces, Director of Personnel. There it is, the coveted piece of paper. You're also given a special little ID thing which you carry around in your pocket that also shows that you are a rated pilot. I believe this is a good time to leave off of this tape right now because the story gets different at this point. And I realize now that I completely forgot to say something about a leave which we were given between basic and advanced flying schools. And unless I'm very much mistaken, I took advantage of this leave and went to Hinsdale, Illinois, to visit Tom and Betty. And whether I went with or met up there or something, I'm not sure which, but I was with another cadet, very nice boy named Russell Kearns. I knew him at flying school, but not very well. But I believe he's from Chicago, that area. Anyway, we went up there together and decided we'd come back together, too. Somehow, one of us found out that General Weaver, who happened to be the general in command of the Southeast, the entire Southeast Air Corps Training Center, was in Chicago at the time and would be flying back to someplace or other in South Carolina on the same day we wanted to go. So Kearns and I conceived this notion of going out to the airport in Chicago and seeing if we could get a ride with General Weaver back to South Carolina. And we appeared out there and somehow found out when General Weaver was supposed to leave. And we went up to the pilot of the airplane, which was a C-47 with regular seats in it. The pilot was a full colonel who boasted a swagger stick, I remember. And we walked up to him very formally and officially and saluted and asked permission to speak and blah, blah, blah. And we asked if we could go back to South Carolina in the general's plane. And the long and short of it was that permission was granted. And I remember we were put on the airplane first. There was a sergeant there who sort of was an aide. Well, that isn't right. I think he might have done some cooking. He was more like a valet or something, I don't know. And there was a co-pilot that I don't remember anything about whatsoever. And there was also a major who was in the medical corps. He was a doctor. And finally, on board came General Weaver himself. And he just nodded to us. Of course, this was an airplane that held at least 21 people, and there were only a handful of us, if that. And the general went up and took a seat up towards the front somewhere. And aside from nodding to us, ignored us completely. But somewhere during the flight, I remember that the steward, the sergeant, went up to the General Weaver with a box of chocolates. And a few minutes later, he appeared back at our seats and said that the general had asked us to share some of his candy with him. And we each very politely and conservatively took one piece each. And the sergeant said, the general said for you to have a lot. So we took several pieces. I never did talk to the general, but the general did send for Kearns and had him come up and sit in the seat beside him and talk to him. As I remember Kearns' report, he just wanted to know where he was and what he was doing and how he liked it and so on. Well, we finally arrived down in South Carolina. I can't remember for the life of me the place now. It's a well-known place because it was a big golf course there, well-known throughout the eastern USA, but it makes no difference. The fact was that it was just after dark, and Kearns and I were in some puzzlement about what we would do next, so we had to go back to Shaw Field at that point. And we were standing outside the plane, and some officious lieutenant came bustling up to us and said, "What are you men doing here? You have no business here. What are you doing here?" And at that point, the major, the doctor, walked up to the lieutenant and said, "These men are with me. I'll thank you to mind your own business," and took us off. And he took us over someplace and ordered a car and told the driver of the car to take us to the nearest railroad station. And we did so, and got on a train and got back to Moultrie and reported into the base the next morning sometime, having had what we considered to be a high adventure. Now, I told you that after our graduation and being turned into second lieutenants on the 3rd of July, I had plans, as did everybody else, to go on leave, and I was going to Harrisonburg and other people going other places, but I did not go on that on July 3rd because there was no train until the next day. So I stayed on the base, and so did a certain number of other people. I'm not sure that the details of what I'm about to say are exactly correct, but it doesn't make any difference whether they are or not. The way I remember it now was that when the time came for me to leave the base, I was told instead I could not leave the base and that I must report to the officers' club at once. And I did that. As time went on, I found myself in the company, as people came in one by one, of 20 other cadets who had just graduated along with me the day before, and all of whom had not left the base and the day before, and when they attempted to, they were prevented. Most of these people had been assigned elsewhere, but of course, I had been assigned to duty at Spence Field anyway. To do what? I have no idea. Anyway, we hung around for a while, and eventually there turned up the Commandant of Cadets, who said, "You boys are being sent overseas tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you where, but," he said, "my advice to you is to get rid of all your good clothes." That was bad advice, incidentally, but everybody took it. And he said, tomorrow morning we will arrange transportation for you. Or I believe it was that same night, the night of that same day. Doesn't make any difference. I did have time to get my clothes packed in a box and sent home to Harrisonburg, the good clothes, so-called, and kept only a minimum of stuff with me, all summer clothing. And hung around till the time came to leave. I remember phoning Mother and explaining to her that I wasn't going to be able to come home after all, and I could not furthermore tell her where I was going. Whether I knew or not at the time, I'm not sure, but I think I did. But I wasn't at liberty to divulge it. Now is as good a time as any to mention the fact that among the people who had been caught up in this roundup, that's what it always seemed like to me, was a boy that I didn't know at all but had wanted to know. I'd seen him at Spence Field many times, and